Hi, I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Anyone with a child in their life knows the pleasure of taking that visit to the bookstore and picking up a copy of their favorite kids' book to share with the next generation. Books like Goodnight Moon, The Snowy Day, and Where the Wild Things Are have become classics in their own right. But it wasn't always so obvious what kids should read and what made a good children's book. In fact, the field is still evolving today. Just look at Harry Potter. Who knew children would read a book 400 pages long? Well, this hour we'll take a look at the evolution of children's literature and hear the stories behind some favorite books as well, and find out what children's books reveal about all of us. Our guest this hour is Leonard Marcus. He is one of the world's leading experts on American children's books. His latest is called Minders of Make-Believe, Idealists, Entrepreneurs, and the Shaping of American Children's Literature. Leonard Marcus is also a book reviewer for Parenting Magazine. And Leonard Marcus, we'll be getting to you in just a moment here. I also want to invite you to call in this hour with your thoughts and feelings about children's books. What are your questions, and what are the favorite books that you've liked to share? The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Leonard Marcus, thanks for joining us this hour.
It's very nice to be with you.
Well, children's literature is a booming business today, and we pretty much take it for granted that childhood and reading, or at least, you know, reading to a child, they go hand in hand. But this wasn't always so obvious, was it?
Well, I think there was always some interest in having children read, but the question was, what should they read? You know, going back to colonial times, the Puritans were very focused on saving souls, and so learning to read the Bible by the age of 3 or 4 was their idea of what was good for children to read. And for the next 150 years, morality and offering children stories that taught them right from wrong was the key. But then later, people began to take a different outlook and to see that, to believe that fiction and fantasy was actually a way of opening a child's mind up. And that's kind of the world we live in now.
Well, when you talk about initially people trying to write books or to give children books that instructed in morality, who was it that was deciding these things at the time? Who were the arbiters of what children's books should be?
Well, many of the early children's books were written by ministers. And later on, educators became involved with whatever theory they had about the best way to teach children. Only gradually, literary people began to become involved. And I think, interestingly, it was after the Civil War in America that that literary writers began paying more attention to kids. And wars have always been very important, oddly and interestingly, in the history of children's books. After a war, you see a great outburst of creativity in the way of children's literature. And I think it's because children's books are the literature of hope. And after a war, the adult generation that was responsible for the war, you know, was looking to the future and wants to make the world a better place.
Well, you talked about the Civil War, and as I understand it, it was after the Civil War that sort of fiction got the green light. Before that, it was thought of as a little dodgy for kids.
Right. I think that the war was so violent and so all-pervasive in American society that it shook people's sense of moral certainty. And whereas in the past, it was very common for people to fashion a story for children, which there was a good boy and a bad boy, or a good girl and a bad girl. And the child reading that was supposed to see very clearly. It was like a roadmap of how to live and what would happen to you if you chose the wrong path. But after the war, you started having characters who were more ambiguous, and Mark Twain might be the very best example of that. Tom Sawyer is kind of a naughty boy, and yet we like him because we know that he's acting the way people, kids really do act.
That reminds me of one of the editors in your book, your pioneering editors of children's literature, who said she wanted good books for naughty children.
Right. Yeah, her exact words were good books for bad children. That was Ursula Nordstrom, and she headed Harper's publishing department from about 1940 to the early 70s. She, just to give you a sense of what she did, she published Goodnight Moon, Where the Wild Things Are, Harriet the Spy, Charlotte's Web, an amazing list of the books that have come to be classics in the last 50 years. And she was very disturbed by the sentimentality of the children's books that she found when she came into the field. You know, kids were always presented as very, very sweet and not having any problems or any worries. They were never allowed to be angry in books or to really express themselves. And she had grown up as the daughter of two famous vaudevillians, so she had a very dramatic childhood household. And her parents divorced when she was very young, so she saw from experience how children could be deeply hurt even at an early stage in life. And so she dedicated herself to making books that were much more emotionally honest than books had been before. So, for instance, Charlotte's Web, you know, ends with the heroine, who happens to be a spider, dying as part of the natural process of life. That was controversial at the time, but she thought it was very important to show that that can happen. Where the Wild Things Are was the first book in which a kid, young child, throws a tantrum. And that was also kind of controversial when it was first published. But she thought that those were real emotions that all children have, and a book can be helpful in allowing children to see that the feelings they have, the ones they don't even have names for because they're so young and new to life, that those feelings are valid and are a part of life.
Was she sort of the first one to champion having more realistic kids' books?
Well, certainly, on the emotional level, I would say that's true. She met with a great deal of resistance, and for years, none of her books won Newbery and Caldecott medals. It was always the nice books that won. But but after a while, people realized that there was such intensity and authenticity behind her books, you know, that that she kind of eventually won the day. Marie Sendak had illustrated something like 40 books and been the runner-up many, many times for various awards before he finally won the Caldecott Medal in 1964 for Where the Wild Things Are. That was really a watershed book.
It was, because it was really this kid really acting out. You know, he wasn't a model, Max, of good kids' behavior by any means. He basically had a giant fit and was characterized in the book or dramatized as this rumpus with these crazy-looking monsters. And in some ways, you know, that's a difficult book, isn't it?
Well, some people found it so. Even Bruno Bettelheim, the psychoanalyst, wrote a column saying he thought it was too strong for children because it implies that a mother is capable of denying her child nourishment, you know, by sending him away without his supper. But it's all in the details, really, and in the art. And Sendak acknowledged those feelings that children have, but within the framework of a story that works itself out through the child's own imagination. And so it's really a very empowering story. While some people point it to the wild things, the monsters, as being too scary to put in a bedtime book for children, when you really look at them, they have these sort of dumb grins on their faces. And they're as silly, at least, as they are scary. And this was Sendak's way of saying to the child, you know, I know you're smart enough to figure this out.
Well, Sendak, he started out just illustrating for other people, for writers, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, he started out as a young kid, really, a 20, 22-year-old who hadn't gone to college, who had been drawing since he was at least a teenager, and, you know, had kind of raw talent that he mostly developed on his own. And was discovered by Ursula Nordstrom, the editor we were speaking about a moment ago, while he was working in the window display department at the toy store FAO Schwartz in Manhattan. The head of the book department at the store introduced the two of them, and she got to see his notebooks that way and immediately hired him to illustrate another writer's book. And she cultivated him and gave him all sorts of assignments, realistic stories, fairy tales, to stretch him and not let him get pegged or in a rut in any way. And 40 books later, you know, he was capable of doing really a perfect book that in every aspect, you know, strengthens the story that it sets out to tell.
Well, you also mentioned Good Night Moon by Margaret Wise Brown, and that's one that's pretty interesting, too, that we take it, again, for granted now. It's one of those obvious first books of childhood that we give our children, but it was, at the time, pretty groundbreaking.
Yeah, people thought it was very odd at the time that it was new, and in fact, the salespeople at the publishing house were told not to show it to booksellers, to just try to sell it blindly, because there are only 300 words in that book, and as people who've looked at it will know, there's basically only one illustration, which you see over and over again from different angles, sometimes in black and white, sometimes in color. It's the child's bedroom, and it's all about the things that are in that room and the comfort that a small child can draw from what's familiar to his own world. And it didn't tell a story either. So librarians who love to have story hours didn't see much there for them to make use of. And parents thought they weren't getting a good deal from just 300 words. So it got some good reviews and then languished for a while. And then, in the 50s, book was published in 47, and then 5 or 6 years later, as the baby boom was really getting underway, there started to be advice columnists around America publishing in newspapers. And pair of advice columnists who wrote together, known as Ilg and Ames, recommended the book as the perfect book for your young child who won't go to sleep at night. And they mentioned it repeatedly. They kept telling people about it, and they built up word of mouth, and that sent the book off on its skyrocketing career as one of the best-selling children's books of all time. One of the interesting things about Good Night Moon is that Margaret Wise Brown had studied at the Bank Street College of Education, and which was one of the pioneering centers of progressive education in America. And the book is very much infused with progressive education theory, even though you'd never know it from the simplicity of it, the amazing poetry and simplicity of the book. But Bank Street was all about young children wanting to explore the world immediately around them, and that's exactly what happens inside the Great Green Room.
Well, you've actually written a book about Margaret Wise Brown, and you've looked at Good Night Moon pretty carefully. And I have a question for you, because
sure.
This is a book that I read to my almost three-year-old now. Well, he's kind of outgrowing it, but I've always wondered, what's the deal with the old rabbit in the rocking chair?
What's the deal?
I'm somewhat troubled by the rabbit.
You're troubled by the rabbit.
Well, they couldn't
decide how realistic to make the pictures and how fantastic. And for a while, they tried having a human woman, like a grandmotherly figure, sitting in the chair. But that, of course, clashed with the idea of a bunny as the child, so they went with, an all-bunny cast. It's not clear who she is, but she's a comforting presence. And I think I think that book is all about giving a child a sense of peace at the end of the night and, in a sense, at the beginning of life. Because to very small children, everything in the world is new and therefore potentially confusing or disturbing. And here's a room and a book where everything has its place. And I think it's well documented from experience that children listening to this book create rituals of their own at home as they listen to it, sometimes forcing their parents to read the book to them a certain number of times every night, like three or four times, and sometimes pointing to objects in their own room as a way of extending the story into their own lives. I think one of the really lovely things about that book is that it's written in a simple pattern of naming things. It's a litany, and the pattern is simple enough for a very small child to catch on, and it therefore allows the child, if he or she feels inclined, to really become a collaborator in the making of the book by adding words and objects to mention to say goodnight to on their own.
Well, you're one of the leading experts on American children's books. Do you have a favorite as you've gone along and studied all of these, one that you keep coming back to?
Well, one of the things I've always found fascinating about children's books, and the thing I'm most drawn to, is the ultimate clarity that the best children's books are able to achieve. sort of the ultimate distillation of language and pictures, making them work together. A lot of people dismiss children's books as simple and think that anyone can write one. But that's idea of simplicity is misleading, because really it's a paring away and a getting down to the essence of things. So one of the reasons that I was drawn to write about Margaret Weiss Brown was that she was so gifted at achieving that kind of distillation in a book like Goodnight Moon. So that would certainly be one. And also, I very much admire the picture books by William Steig. One of my favorites is Sylvester and the Magic Pebble. And it's a very funny story, and it's tremendously entertaining to read. But at the same time, it goes to the depths of human emotion, feelings of being lost and alone and separated from your parents. And then when the happy ending finally comes, there's a tremendous sense of joy released in those books, in the story, as well as in the radiant artwork that he created for it.
We're talking this hour about children's literature with our guest, Leonard Marcus. He is one of the world's leading experts on American children's books. His latest, which we're discussing today, is called Minders of Make-Believe. Marcus is also a book reviewer for Parenting Magazine. I hope you'll join in our conversation this hour and tell us about your favorite children's literature, what you give to the children in your life, and what you think it takes to make a great children's book. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 12:30, stay tuned for Chapter a Day. Carl Schmidt reads from The Poet of Tolstoy Park, a novel by Sonny Brewer. A 67-year-old man, given a year to live by his doctors, decides instead to read Tolstoy and perfect his soul. That's Chapter a Day at 12:30 today on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert with you this hour as we talk about children's books with the author of Minders of Make-Believe. Leonard Marcus is our guest today, one of the world's leading experts on American children's books. And Leonard Marcus, it seems as though right now we are in sort of a golden age of children's literature. Some people do say that anyway. Do you agree with that?
I would have to say yes and no. I called the last chapter of my book Suits and Wizards at the Millennium's Gate. And the suits are the business people who run publishing today. And the wizards are partly Harry Potter, but also the many creative people who've come into the field. I'd say that there are more talented artists and writers working to make children's books than ever before. But the corporate climate, which dominates publishing, I think sometimes gets in their way.
And what about the Harry Potter phenomenon? Was this sort of ushered in? This, if you do think of it as a golden age, the business is good right now. Is that thanks to Harry Potter?
Well, it certainly drew much more media attention to children's books than had ever been the case before. And it opened people's minds, I think, adults' minds, to the possibility that children's books have something to offer for people of all ages. Years ago, W.H. Auden, the poet, writing about Alice in Wonderland, said that there are some good children's books which are, rather, there are some good books which are not for children because the experiences they talk about are beyond children's knowing. But there are no good books which are only for children. A really memorable children's book probably has something to say about life that will resonate with adults, too. And I think the just phenomenal popularity of the Harry Potter books has revealed that truth to millions of people around the world.
What do you make of the whole inclusiveness of all the celebrity books now, the Madonna books, the Billy Crystal books, lots of others?
Well, I think this goes back to the unfortunate aspects of corporate publishing. You have a situation now where most books are sold in large chain bookstores where the staff tends not to know the stock very well. You have parents as the main customers for children's books going into those stores not knowing for the most part, what they're looking for. So publishers, as a way of trying to guide these uninformed consumers, which most of us are, go with the familiar. And what could be more familiar than a movie star or musician who you might have seen the night before on The Tonight Show?
I want to get over to our phones now, and let's go ahead and take a call from David in Madison. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. I think it's a great show, and I enjoy the topic.
Great. What do you think? Do you have a favorite book?
I do. One of my favorite books is a book called Babushka, Baba Yaga.
Wow. I haven't heard of that one. Have you heard of that one, Leonard Marcus?
Well, it sounds like a Russian folktale.
Actually, it's a takeoff of a Russian folktale.
Okay.
I don't remember the name of the author, unfortunately. I actually came across the book when I worked at a shelter for abused children. And, of course, when you're trying to get children to take naps, you read them a book. And it's a book about this creature called the Baba Yaga, which in Russian folktale is kind of a mean witch, is the easy way to say it. But the author came across it in her travels to Russia, and she had decided to change it from somebody who had been thought to, you know, do bad things, but was really good and missed having children and wanted to have her own, and so eventually kind of became a babushka, which is a nice term for grandmother, kind of a comforting term for grandmother in Russian, and kind of transitioned from that person to being a caretaker and a wonderful person.
Hmm. Do you know if that book is still in print?
I found it on our bookshelves, and then I liked it so much, I went out and I bought it. So I believe it's still in print. I purchased it about a year or two ago.
What is it that speaks to you about that book? Is it the pictures or the story or both?
The pictures do such a wonderful job of showing what's going on, and the story does such a wonderful job of telling what is going on. It's a really good combination of the two, and it allows me as an adult to be able to get into it, but it allows the children or the kids to get into it really well also. And to me, the story behind the book and the storyline that goes with it is really kind of the wonderful part about it, of how people can be misunderstood, and if all you do is listen to rumor or listen to what people say as opposed to trying to figure things out, you know, to see what's for real, then you can get misled. And then when the reality comes around, you find out really nice things about people.
Hmm. Sounds like a great book. Is that maybe when you're going to look up Leonard Marcus?
Oh, yeah, I think I will.
I have to look for that one. Thank you for that call, David. And we go now to Aaron in Milwaukee. Hello, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I have. I was just driving the car and happened to turn to 90.7 and hear this great piece that you were doing. So I feel fortunate. I was lucky enough to turn the radio on.
I'm glad you were listening.
Goodnight Moon is one of my favorite books that I've read to my two children that are now 6 and 5. It continues to be my favorite book. To me, it's like reading a warm cup of hot chocolate is the kind of feeling you get when you finish the book.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, my kids have outgrown that phase and are more into SpongeBob and scatological-type humor. Captain Underpants is a big favorite of my 6-year-old. I don't know if Mr. Marcus has heard of that.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
They're very, very popular books. In fact, any book that has the word underwear or underpants in the title is apt to become a bestseller.
Right, yeah, absolutely. I'm sure if you wrote a book about gas, it would be a number one seller, since kids just seem to love that kind of humor. So that's my favorite book, but I also have a question for Mr. Marcus about kind of getting in the marketplace if you've written children's books before. I have written a few pieces. I was picked up by a local Wisconsin publisher and kind of went through the process for 3 years, and then the publisher decided to kind of focus on becoming a blogger, and I was dropped, and I was kind of curious how you can make an impact if your last name isn't Crystal or Madonna or something like that.
Oh, well, There are a couple of organizations that are good to know about. One is called the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, which has regional and national conferences every year and a very good website. And they offer lots of information about how to get published, how to connect with agents, and how to find a even how to self-publish. So that would be one good source of information. Also, in a New York-based organization called the Children's Book Council has a very good website with information for authors and illustrators. That would be another way to find out how to go.
Well, thank you for that call, Aaron, and good luck with your book. And talking about self-publishing, you sort of hint, Leonard Marcus, that you think that is one way that the business could go in the future.
Yeah, I think the very big corporate publishers are inefficient, and eventually that's going to become clear to everyone, and some of them may break up into smaller, medium-sized houses. But these days, with technology which is accessible to a great many people, it's possible to produce your own picture book and have it look totally professional. And then, if you're clever enough with the internet, you can solve the big problem, which is how to reach an audience, you know, how to market your work. In the old days, in the 18th and early 19th centuries, that's how publishing proceeded for the most part. Printers who had a printing press in a storefront would produce, you know, posters for people, tickets, receipts for local businesses, and sometimes they would get together with a woodcut artist and produce a few children's books for the local clientele. That's really how publishing started, and it may very well be where it's headed.
We'll go on now to Janet calling from Oconomowoc. Welcome, Janet. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say I was a child in the 50s, so all of the children's books I was exposed to were the sweet variety. But I had a neighbor, Florence Sarah Winship, who was an illustrator for children's books. And when I was 7 and 8 years old, I could go to her house and watch her do her watercolors for these books. And it's just influenced my whole life, how magical books became, and I became a lifelong reader. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the artwork was just so beautiful, and seeing how she decided which pictures to go with the story, it was just an extraordinary experience for a child.
Do you have any of her artwork?
I do. I have Christopher's Hoppy Day, which is about a little boy and a bunny, and I have the picture that she painted, and then I have the book, and she used to make me birthday cards.
Hmm, how wonderful.
Huh. That's interesting. And, you know, Wisconsin has had an important place in the history of American children's books because it was in Racine that Golden Books got started. And the company they were associated with, the Western Printing Company, also had a very extensive line of books called Whitman Books. So I'm sure there were many local or regional illustrators who worked for those companies.
Well, thank you for that call, Janet. Had you heard of the illustrator she mentioned?
No, I haven't, but there really have been so many over the years. It's a very rich field. I think people would be surprised to realize just how many illustrators there have been. I think as a book reviewer, I probably follow the careers of 400 or 500 illustrators who are working now.
Has it always been a given that children's books went hand-in-hand with illustrations?
Yes. The idea can actually be traced back to someone you may have read in college, the philosopher John Locke, who wrote a book on the theory of education in the 1690s. And he was looking at how children learn, and he understood that children have the ability to reason, but their attention span isn't what it becomes when later in life. And he had the idea, a very, very sensible idea, that pictures can help children to understand. And from that moment on, most children's books have been illustrated.
Well, it's interesting because as an adult, when we read the books that we often enjoy, well, at least the fiction books, are ones that we can really deeply and richly imagine. And I wonder if the illustrations, the idea behind that might sort of be that it's training wheels for learning how to use your imagination like that.
Well, I think that's certainly excuse me, an aspect of it. A very good illustrator will say that there are parts of a story that don't need to be illustrated. So it's not as if the illustrations try to show you everything, which is also described in the text. And in fact, the picture book as a genre within children's literature evolved as an art form as talented artists began to realize that what the pictures could do was to tell a second story, a sort of counter story to what the words were saying. So that something very complicated, like a two-part invention in music, begins to develop. And the imagination is just set on fire because you have two stories going in what are essentially two different languages.
Well, what would be different about adult books then? Why do we not use more pictures in grown-up books?
Well, I think it's partly the tradition. Adults are often afraid to see themselves as too childlike or too childish. And because it's become the convention for children's books to be illustrated, I think there's been a kind of balancing attitude of thinking that adult books shouldn't be illustrated. Though you see that changing in the graphic novel.
Right.
I think the two genres, the two worlds of adult literature and children's literature meet and merge to some extent in the graphic novel of today.
Going back to the phones, here's a call from Scott in, I think it's Gyard, Iowa. Hi, Scott, you're on the air.
Hey, I just wanted to bring up two books that I really enjoy. One is Till the Cows Come Home. I can't remember the author. The other one is a book by Ralph Moody. I'm not sure it would be even counted as a child's book. Little Britches. I just wanted to hear your comments on those two if you'd heard of them.
Huh. Well, I seem to be striking out. I don't know those two books, but bear in mind that 8,000 children's books are published in the U.S. every year. So there must be hundreds of thousands all told. On the issue of whether a book is for children or not, I think certainly the publishers classify them as one or the other, but it's always been the case that some books which are published for adults migrate toward a young readership and vice versa. Mark Twain was actually very confused about who his books were for sometimes. He was convinced that Tom Sawyer was the great American novel. His wife told him, no, I think it's a book for boys. And then he wrote Huckleberry Finn thinking that was going to be a children's book, and it turned out to be what some people consider the great American novel.
That's funny. What is... he's not there anymore. I wanted to ask him what Little Britches was about. I knew I have a pretty good idea about Till the Cows Came Home, what that might be about, but something we'll have to research there. Well, I think we're going to take a quick break now as we talk children's literature with Leonard Marcus. He is one of the world's leading experts on American children's books. His latest book is called Minders of Make-Believe, Idealists, Entrepreneurs, and the Shaping of American Children's Literature. I'm hoping you'll join in this hour as well and tell us about your favorite children's books, what you've really enjoyed sharing with the next generation, and what you think it takes to make a really good children's book. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As Wisconsin greens up, how is your lawn coming along? After 11 o'clock, Jim Packer talks with a UW-Madison turfgrass expert about starting and maintaining a healthy lawn. That's Garden Talk coming up after 11 today on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert with you this hour as we talk about children's books with our guest Leonard Marcus. He's the author of the book Minders of Make-Believe. And we're wondering what your favorite children's books are and what you think it takes to make a really good children's book. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. And we'll go back to the phones now, and here is a call from Terry calling from Verona. Hi, Terry, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks very much for having this show. The book that I'd like to recommend is The Miraculous Journey of Edward Tulane. It was published in 2006, and its author is Kate D. Camillo. Are you familiar with that book at all?
Oh, yes, I am, sure.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's just a fabulous crossover book.
Mm-hmm. It's a great book to read out loud, too.
Right. I've been doing that. My son is only 7 years old, but he really enjoys the book, and we've read it several times through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a,
and I just wanted to say, you know, it is somewhat a complex, you know, mythic quest in that he... makes these journeys, these involuntary quests, and finds love. But it's interesting because it really also is beautifully illustrated.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I think, and it has a very compelling storytelling voice. I think that's one of the qualities which makes some children's books memorable, the feeling of being sort of embraced by the storyteller and sort of wrapped in the warmth of their knowingness about the world. And that's the quality that I think comes through in that book.
What is that book about? It's one I haven't heard of.
Well, it's about a toy rabbit that gets separated from its owner and manages one way or another to sort of travel around the world and falling into the hands of various other people along the way. So it's a story about being lost and found.
Hmm. Well, there seems to be a lot of books with bunnies in them. They seem to be a popular character for children's books. And we have a question via email saying, this is from Liz in Oregon, who said she's always been impressed by the feminist message in The Country Bunny. And can you please speak to Margaret's philosophy on The Radical Book, where a female rabbit joins the rank of Easter Bunny? Can you tell us about that book? Do you know The Country Bunny?
I've read it years ago. I don't have anything very much to say about that at the moment, though. I think you find all kinds of social messages in children's books, though. And certainly, you know, I think there is a feminist aspect to children's books, in part because so many women have had a chance to write and illustrate them over the years.
Are there any other books that spring to mind as maybe children's books that did have sort of a feminist or pro-woman message?
I think all of Ursula Le Guin's fantasies are strongly feminist books. And, you know, they feature godlike characters who are female. And Madeleine L'Engle's novels like A Wrinkle in Time, you know, the heroine is Meg, a girl who is seen by her teachers as being not so bright, but actually that isn't the case at all. She's just different and, in a sense, in her own world. But she's able to go out and literally into the universe and help save her father and bring her family back together. You know, Charlotte in Charlotte's Web, though a spider, is a female and a kind of nature mother. Who manages to bring order and save life in the barnyard, which stands for the world. So I think children's books are very well supplied with feminist heroes, heroines.
Going back to A Wrinkle in Time by Madeleine L'Engle, that's one that I was in love with when I was a teenager or a kid. I can't remember how old I was when I read them. And it was interesting reading your book at the time. Those books were, at least the first one, that was kind of a hard sell for her, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was rejected by 26 publishers and then finally picked up for Strauss and Giroux. There's been a very long tradition in America of discomfort with fantasy. And it goes back to Puritan times when the Bible was the ultimate truth, and any story which deviated from reality as depicted in the Bible was viewed as somehow sacrilegious, or at least a distraction from the serious business of learning to know the world according to the Bible. Most fiction for children throughout the 19th century was realistic fiction. I mean, you can think of Little Women. You can think of many obscure books that aren't read at all anymore. And even writers like, closer to our own time, like Beverly Cleary and Judy Blume are writers who are very much in the tradition of realism. So fantasy was a hard sell. And I think that it was only when we reached the nuclear age, you know, when the people could begin to imagine the unimaginable, a world really going up in smoke, that more people became open to the idea of reading about other worlds and, you know, other ways of thinking about the world. We really needed to open our minds in a way that only fantasy allows us to do.
Well, fantasy is obviously really hot right now with the Harry Potter books and the Philip Pullman books. Do you think that that is a market that's going to sort of run its course and we'll go back to more realistic things? I don't know, like the Penderwick series, which is sort of big right now. Mm-hmm. Or do you think fantasy is here to stay?
I think we're in a time when there's receptivity to many kinds of stories. I think that's one of the very best things about the children's book world as it is now. You know, Harry Potter had 7 books, and each one was longer than the last. And you see, or I see as a book reviewer, almost an amusing trend of publishers, you know, wanting to figure out the formula of that stupendous success by publishing multi-volume series in the fantasy vein that are almost too heavy to pick up. You know, the bigger the book, the better it seems. You know, and that part of it is certainly going to run its course, because as I sometimes think in exasperation, how many other worlds can there possibly be? You know, I think fantasy writers have come up with as many of the variations on that theme as perhaps exist. But there's a substantial amount of very fine fantasy writing, and that's not going to go away, and it will continue to inspire younger writers to add to the tradition.
Going back to the phones, let's take a call from Marty, joining us from Milwaukee. Go ahead, Marty.
Thank you so much. I'm kind of wondering about a book that I fell in love with in 5th and 6th grade called The Phantom Tollbooth.
Oh, yeah.
You know, illustrated by Jules Feiffer. But what I'm wondering about is I really don't hear about that book anymore, and I'm wondering if that's an example of genres that come and go. I remember that the book did not, you know, talk down to me as a child at all. In fact, it kind of pulled me upwards into a world where, you know, what seemed to be wasn't really, and it was lots of wordplay, very intelligent. But I'm not familiar with, I don't know that that book is still as popular as it might have been years and years ago. Do those kinds of things come and go?
Well, I think if you look around, you'll see that many people are still reading the book. My guess is that a lot of college students read it now, people who are older than the original audience. And it's about to turn 50 years old in a couple of years. And I happen to know that a theater version of the book was just produced at the Kennedy Center and is now on a national tour, which you know, is filling the house. So I think there still is quite a bit of interest in that book. I've always thought of it as the Alice in Wonderland of our time, because as with Lewis Carroll, as you say, it's full of really ingenious wordplay and a philosophical outlook on life. You know, here's this little boy, Milo, magically going off into an unknown, unexpected world, starting from his own bedroom, and meeting all kinds of people and all kinds of creatures, and having to face situations for which no one could possibly have prepared him. So it's, you know, it's a classic metaphor for life itself, and to that extent, I think it's a timeless story.
Thanks a lot for the call, Marty. And we go on to Kathleen calling from Door County. Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
What makes children's books really work? As a former teacher, I was thinking about that as I was waiting to get on. And I think that your caller just hit on one thing, the previous caller, when he said a book that he was talking about the book he enjoyed, and it didn't talk down to him. And children love stories that they can relate to, that are about the human experiences, and don't talk down to them. I also find that they like a bit of magical element in their stories, and also books that just touch their spirit. And so when I think of some of the favorite books that I've shared with children, Cynthia Ryland comes to mind. Kindergarten and first graders particularly love her Henry and Mudge series, and those are excellent for early readers, that they can, one of the first books in first grade that they can read. And just this little boy and his everyday experiences with his great big dog, Mudge. Cynthia Ryland also has the Mr. Putter and Tabby books, which are about an old widowed man and his cat. And there's humor in both of those books, but there's just these experiences that children love and can relate to. She's got a picture book out called The Van Gogh Cafe that is a very magical story about a little cafe and the magical things that happen to the people that come and go into the cafe. And my students have always loved that as well.
Is that a newer book?
I don't think it's real new. I'm going to guess, though, within the last 10 years.
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah. I'm guessing on that. But then, also, some of the books that I have found will leave my children, like, just as they're gathered around and I'm reading, that will leave them just in silence. There are some beautiful Christmas books out, and one is a book by Pearl S. Buck, Christmas Day in the Morning, that was first published in 1955. And that is the story about a young boy. I think he's like maybe preteen, and he lives on a farm. And every morning, his father gets him up very early before school to go out and help with the chores. And one in time, he overhears his father telling his mother how hard it is and how that he has to get his son up every morning, wake him up so early. And in that overhearing that, the boy realizes how much his father loves him. And it's Christmas time, and he wants to do something for his father, and he has no money. So the story is about how he gets up so early on Christmas morning, and he goes out alone, and he does the chores, and he comes back in bed, and his father comes in and tells him, you know, it's time to get up, and his father says, I'll go ahead, but come on out. And his father goes out, and the tenderness that Pearl S. Buck writes about how he comes back to the boy's room, and he just stands in the doorway and tells him, that is the nicest thing that anyone's ever done for me.
Hmm.
My children love that book.
It sounds beautiful.
It is beautiful. And speaking of beautiful books, Eve Bunting's December is a not, you have to read that with young children. It is the story about a homeless mother and her son. They live in a cardboard box, and they open up their door on Christmas Eve to another homeless woman who, the book is about, is she or is she not an angel who comes and spends Christmas Eve night with them? So that's another one. And the last one, the last one that I will comment on, back to Cynthia Ryland, her wonderful book, Silver Skates, about a young boy who grows up in the Appalachian Mountains, and it's about giving back to your community. It's about giving back. So I'll leave it at that. But those are some of my favorite authors and children's books.
Yeah. That's
Thanks
a,
so much, Kathleen.
Quite a list there. Yeah. I wanted to say something about the Henry and Mudge books.
Uh-huh.
Because they are an example of a kind of children's book which was invented in the 1950s, the beginning reader book. And the very first examples of those were The Cat in the Hat by Dr. Seuss and Little Bear by Elsa Minerick, illustrated by Marie Sendak. And it's an interesting example of publishers inventing a new kind of book, a new genre of books, to meet what was perceived as an important social need. In the 50s, the height of the Cold War, Americans were deeply worried that their children weren't reading and being as well-educated as Soviet children were. There were articles in Life magazine, breastfeeding kinds of articles, saying, why can't Johnny read? Independently, serendipitously, editors at two publishing houses had the idea that if they could come up with a kind of book which looked more like an older book than a picture book does, was in other words, in a smaller trim size, closer to that of a novel, and yet thinner, maybe just 64 pages, and with not that many words on the page, and with short sentences with relatively easy words, and with occasional pictures to carry you along, the way Water Wings does, as one of the callers said earlier, that that kind of book would provide a very satisfying experience for a child who was just beginning to read independently, so they would feel the great sense of getting to the finish line. And that's how a whole new genre of children's books came into being. And now there are hundreds, if not thousands, of books of that kind. And Cynthia Ryland is perhaps the very best person of our time at writing books in that vein.
Yeah, we have a lot of Henry and Mudge books in heavy rotation at my house right now, too. They're really good. You know, but listening to Kathleen talk, she had that list for us and the affection in her voice. It struck me how deeply connected we feel to children's books, even when we're adults. And I wouldn't be surprised, you know, how when inmates are sort of on death row, they get a last meal. If people got to choose a last book that they read, the very last book in their life, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people chose children's books.
Huh. Yeah, well, I mean, we're at our most impressionable when we're young, and in a sense, at our most emotionally vulnerable. You know, we're reaching out to the universe for a feeling of being connected to it, and the right book can just resonate with a young person and continue to do so for life.
Do you have any books that you feel that strongly about, or current books that you think we should know about?
Let's see.
Too many to choose from.
Yeah, there's so much to choose from. I think everyone should know some of the books by James Marshall, for instance.
Okay.
You know, his books about George and Martha, there are, I think, seven of them. They're funny on the surface, but they're also about getting along with your peers.
Are those the hippo books?
Yeah.
Yeah, we have one
right.
of those. Those
I mean, they're
fun.
Charming, and they're also deeply true. I think there are any number of books that manage both to be entertaining and also to have something to say about life.
Well, thank you so much. I'm afraid we have to leave it there, but it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We've been talking with Leonard Marcus, one of the world's leading experts on American children's books. His latest is called Minders of Make-Believe. And I want to thank Carmen Jackson for producing the last hour, Rhonda Fanning for this hour, and also Sarah Carroll. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.